Hello, Greg. This is Wednesday, the 10th of February, 1993. And as requested by you, I'd like to give you a resume of my Scientology reminiscences. And first off, we'll start off with part one. This cassette will be part one. And this will be named The Early Years. I realised at the outset that this whole project is quite meaningless without some a listener to the tape having some understanding or some knowledge of me as a person. So I better give a few personal details. I was born on the 3rd of February 1927 in London, England, in the suburb of Tottenham, N15, and I was the only son of two working class parents. At that time, the suburb of Tottenham was a slum or semi-slum area on the northern part of inner London, you might say. It had been in its time, 30 or 40 years earlier, it had been quite an affluent suburb, but it had gone downhill rather badly, and when I was born into it, it was definitely a slum, semi-slum area. My earliest memories as a child, as a young child, was of other children who always seemed hungry and always seemed badly clothed and badly housed. And they all seemed to come from enormously large families. Nobody owned their houses. The whole block, whole area where we lived was owned by the local bedstead factory or the local laundry. They owned all the property and they were all the houses were out on rentals. It's difficult for us to understand these days the grinding poverty which was rampant in that area at that time. It was a sort of area where the girl next door every Monday morning would take her father's Sunday suit, which he wore all day Sunday and got out of on Sunday night, and she took his Sunday suit in a wheelbarrow down to the local pawnbroker shop before she went to school on Monday morning and hocked it for 5 shillings. And there it would stay all week until Father got paid on Friday. When he came home on Friday, he would pay his wife the housekeeping money. And on Saturday morning, the girl would go down with the wheelbarrow with 6 shillings and hand that over to the pawnbroker and reclaim the suit. And then her father could wear his Sunday best suit again. It was that sort of grinding poverty. All the children I knew seemed to be parts of large families. I seem to be largely the exception, that I was the only child. My father, both my parents were working class, but father had a regular job in a factory. He didn't earn all that much money. He didn't earn any more money than any of the other men did. But what made him a cut above the other men financially was that he only had one child to support, and also he didn't smoke and he didn't drink, and he otherwise saved his money. So we were never grindingly short of money, although we were never affluent. The landlord always made sure of that. I suppose the main thing I learnt from those first 11 years of my life living in that slum area of Tottenham was to give me a deep and abided hatred of capitalism, because I only saw the evil face of capitalism. I saw the rich going past in their big cars, and I saw the grinding poverty of the poor. And I used to think, when I got a little older, I used to think, God, there's got to be a better way to do this. But evidently, here we are 60 years later, and we still have our slums, and we still have the rich going past in the cars, and mankind still hasn't found a better way to do it. Difficult for us today in the 90s to understand the world in London of the early 30s, when I was a young child. There was no there was no electricity, for example, in the road where we lived. So although you could buy radio sets, you had to have them run on a battery. And Dad used to have a battery-operated radio set, which had a mass of batteries, which had to, every 2 or 3 weeks, spent half a week in the local store being recharged up. So our radio was a rather chancy affair. Dad used to tinker with it. And so on. Most of the people didn't have a radio. I think it was only two, put two or three other houses in the whole street that they had a radio. They were quite rare. There was no electricity. We had gas. All the lighting was by gas. Motor cars. Well, nobody in the street, the whole street, nobody owned a motor car. And one shopkeeper, who he didn't live there, he used to park his car outside his corner shop on the corner of the road, and that was the only car us children ever had a chance really to examine. We used to go and walk around this car and have a look at this remarkable object, this car. You could go up to the main road and see plenty of them going past, but none of them ever seemed to stop in the slum area, and it simply wasn't an area where people owned cars. They simply hadn't got the money. When I got to 11 years of age, we upped and left that area, and Dad bought a house in Edgware, which is 10 miles to the northwest of London, and he'd saved up the £30 deposit for the new house for Mum and I and himself. £30 doesn't sound very much these days, but the average wage, the wage he was earning, which was about the average wage for a factory worker, was about £2 a week in 1938. So it was 15 weeks wages the deposit was on the house. Well, today the average wage is about $500 a week in Australia. So 15 times 500 is about $7,500. It would be the equivalent of a man saving up $7,500 these days for the deposit on the house, whilst carrying a rental and raising a one-child family. It took him a few years to save it, nevertheless. Most of the people in the road never managed it. Their families were too large, they drank too much beer. They simply never managed to get off the treadmill of the landlord. But as I say, Dad did, and we got the house in Edgware, and by this time, I was always rather bright at school. I was usually somewhere near the top of the class. I was above average intelligence as a lad, and I passed my 11 plus examinations and breezed through those all right, and was headed off to the local grammar school, or the county school as they used to call it in those days, where I resided until I was 17. And I was all set to go on to a career where I would get a degree in science and mathematics. They were my interests. At least the teachers told me that's where I would be going, and it seemed all right by me. But a hiatus occurred when I was 15 years of age, and when I suddenly developed a great yearning, a great love of playing a jazz on a clarinet, and I wanted to be an Artie Shaw and a Benny Goodman. Dad very generously forked out the money to buy me a clarinet, and he paid for my lessons to learn to play the instrument. And of course, all the time I spent learning to play the instrument, that was the end of my academic expectations. They went out the window in favour. I simply didn't spend enough time on my studies, my school studies. I ended up at 17 and a half as a better than average jazz clarinetist and saxophonist. But a rather poor academic prospect for a science degree. Now, regarding my personality, I suppose I would have been regarded as a rather backward, shy person. That was always the main characteristic. Mum always said that you're more shy than most boys, and I was rather shy and backward, and thoughtful, a great reader, but shyness, nervousness in public was my great thing. She always said, Mum, that you'll grow out of it, but I never did. When I got into adolescence, my shyness got worse and worse and worse, and it gave me I started to study psychotherapy and read all the works of Freud. I knew there was something not quite right inside the mechanism of my mind somewhere, and I was trying to figure out what it was. Hence my interests. My own shyness gave me a tremendous interest in psychotherapy. So I left the county school at 17 and a half. That would have been at the end of the war. We weren't affected all that much in terms of bombing by the war in northwest London. It was too far. It was the far side of London, away from where the bombs were being dropped. We had less bombs dropped in the Edgware region than almost any other part of London. If we'd have stayed in Tottenham, of course, we would have been blasted out of existence, because soon after the war, I cycled back to the road where I was born in, and the whole estate, it simply didn't exist. It took me almost half an hour to even find where the road was. It was just a mass of weeds and an overgrown bomb wreckage. There was absolutely no sign of the house where I'd lived in. The whole thing had just been bombed to a complete oblivion by the German Air Force. So I left school and got myself a local job. I was never particularly interested in business. As I say, my hatred of capitalism, I just didn't care for business. I didn't care for capitalism. My childhood influence there, I'd seen too much of the bad side of it. I simply was not interested in capitalism and the business that goes with capitalism. I was more interested in music, and I wanted to go in and become a professional musician. Unfortunately, I probably could have become a professional musician, but unfortunately, when I was a baby, I'd had a mastoidectomy, and it had left me hospitalised when I was 3 months of age as a baby, and with a mastoidectomy. And the operation to both my ears had left me with only about 60% hearing. And there was absolutely nothing could be done about that. That was the way it was. I mean, the whole of my life, as far as I can remember, I've never had more than 60% of normal hearing. So that put paid to my aspirations to being really a professional, a top flight professional musician. Because one thing a professional musician, instrumentalist, needs, he needs absolutely spot perfect hearing. He can get by with bad eyesight, but he can't get by with bad hearing. So I was pretty well doomed to a semi-professional role, and that's exactly what I did from late 1940s. I was working in a dead-end office job in the daytime, and in the evenings I was out two or three nights a week with my saxophone and clarinet playing in dance bands. I was earning a lot of money, and I was earning money in the daytime. I was unmarried. I was saving a fair bit of money. It was after the war. There was nothing much to buy. There was nothing in the shops. And I was just stacking the money away. So it all came in very useful later, this money did. I'll explain. The other great love of my life was that time was science fiction. In fact, almost the only fiction I ever read as an adolescent was science fiction. I was introduced to it at school. And it was a great rave amongst all us lads at school. Many of us were great science fiction fans, and it stayed with me after I left the school. I loved the Astounding Science Fiction, which later became Analog, and all the science fiction magazines and all the books on science fiction. L. Ron Hubbard was one of my favourite authors, and Isaac Asimov, Theodore Sturgeon, all the boys who were writing good stuff, good stories of science fiction. They were really the golden years of science fiction, was around about the 1940s and 50s. And I used to just gobble this stuff up. At that time, I had an airmail subscription to the Astounding Science Fiction magazine in New York. And so it was in May 1950, when the article on Dianetics came out in the Astounding Science Fiction magazine. I got it a few days after it was released in America. The book was air freighted over to England, and I read that article by L. Ron Hubbard avidly, and I was hooked, unashamedly from the word go. This, when I read the article, I thought, well, this, I've read a lot of psychotherapy, I've read a lot of psychology, but this looks different. This is written by an engineer. And here is an engineering approach to the subject of the mind. My own studies in mathematics and science and so forth had given me an appreciation of the engineering approach, and I thought that was the way to go about it. And so I instantly got in touch with my local bookseller and got him to arrange for a copy of the book to be sent over to me pronto, to be emailed over as quickly as possible, no expense spared. And there was some delay on the subject of the book. I never got it as quickly as I was hoped I could get it, but it was around about September 1950 before I actually got the book, after a few delays, none of which were my fault, all to do with the bookseller. But it was September 1950 when I got the book, read the book, one weekend I got it. It was the, he phoned me up, the bookseller, on the Saturday morning, said, the book's here. He said, if you can collect it, or I'll post it out to you. So I got on, it was right on the other side of London. I remember got on my motorbike and went all the way across to Stoke Newington on the Saturday morning and got back in time for lunch with the book in my hot little hand. And I spent the whole weekend reading Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, and finished it late on Sunday night. There would be no exaggeration to say that I was in a whirl. My head was in an absolute whirl when I read that. It was some—it was a milestone in my life. I could hardly wait to get started. But before I could get started, I needed a co-auditor. I needed somebody to audit me, and I needed somebody to be able to audit. And so I was looking around me to find a co-auditor. That meant somebody else. I had to read the book, and I had the only copy of the book. There's no way that anybody else would get the book quickly, so that it was a question of lending out my copy. So I went around all my old school friends, who I'd stayed in touch with. There's about half a dozen of them. We used to go out drinking in my spare time, and one by one I approached them on the subject of this book and lent them the book. And I was absolutely amazed and disappointed at the cool reception that I got. And there was only one fellow, Nobby, one of the half a dozen, who was interested. He read the book and was impressed by the book, and he had a few psychological problems of his own, and he was willing to have a go. Of course, I was very young at the time, very inexperienced, and what I didn't know was that, something I've learnt since, that the vast majority of the human race have a built-in objection to anyone tampering with their mind. Whether it's done by a qualified psychiatrist or whether it's done by a rank amateur, they simply will not have anybody tinker with their mind. And this is a most peculiar state of affairs when you look at it objectively, because this same person who will not have, under any circumstances, have anyone tinker with their mind, will quite happily go to a doctor, to a surgeon, and be put under an anaesthetic, and have their carcass opened up and all their innards spread out on an operating table and examined, and some repair made to their heart or to their to an artery somewhere, and some complex operation, or to their intestine system, and have it all put back in, and it'll all be sewn up. And they'll come out of the anaesthetic and recover and so on. They don't think there's anything odd about this at all. In other words, I don't think there's anything odd about a surgeon going in and tinkering with the innards of their body. But the idea of somebody asking them a few questions about their mind and about their memories and their past and so forth, no, they will not have that. Now, that is a peculiar state of affairs when you look at it quite objectively. It's a peculiarity of the human species, because objectively it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. There's very few people can grasp this, but I can grasp it. Grasp it objectively. You look at it objectively, it's most peculiar, this strange rejection. So it was not unusual that a sample of six young men there, who were introduced to Dianetics in 1950, only one of the six was interested to follow through on it. And he wasn't wildly enthusiastic. He was much more cautious than I was. But anyway, Nobby and I got, he read the book thoroughly from cover to cover, and we compared notes and so forth, and decided on a co-auditing program. And we got underway towards the end of September 1950, got our co-auditing underway. I didn't know it at the time, but we were almost certainly the second co-auditing team to start in the United Kingdom. There was nothing being done. The only earlier ones than us was George Wishlow, who started auditing a pre-clear early. His first pre-clear he put down into therapy was in early September, and he knows of no one else that was auditing in September except himself. By October, of course, it was different. There were many were starting up, but almost certainly Nobby and I were the second, we were doing the sec- were the second coal auditing team in the whole of the British Isles. I've looked into this, and I've never come across anyone who was auditing that earlier than that, except George Wishlow, who was auditing in early September. But more about George Wishlow later. As soon as I got book one, of course, there was a little card in there which you could return back to the publishers in America for further information on the subject of Dianetics. And I filled that card in and airmailed that off to America. And a few weeks later, I got a letter from the Dianetic Research Foundation in Elizabeth, New Jersey. That was Ron's organisation, and giving me a up-to-date data and so forth. And also giving me the names and addresses of half a dozen Dianetic groups that are already formed in the United States. It's almost impossible for us to realise at this time that the wild enthusiasm that there was in certain quarters, in America particularly, with Dianetics, it literally took that country by storm. And by September, 1950, there were Dianetic groups springing up all over America. And two or three months afterwards, by October, November, they were springing up in London too. The book did go to the top. It was a bestseller, and those who were interested were wildly enthusiastic, and there was no hold bars on the communication line. There was nobody was withholding communication on this subject. Every communication was welcome. And I got in touch with the American groups. Every address I was sent, I wrote to and got replies back to them. Some of them had already got newsletters starting up, and I became a sort of a communication terminal. They were writing. There was only George Wishlow at that time, who they also knew of in England, and now there was Dennis Stevens in Edgware, and miles of stuff started turning up in my mail. Because the groups in America were telling other groups in America that there's a guy over there called Stevens who's interested in America, in England. And so miles of stuff was turning up in the mail from the various groups, and so I was spending a hell of a lot of time writing off to these groups in America with my own experiences and enjoying reading their newsletters and so forth. And one of the other things I got back from the Elizabeth Foundation was the address of George Wishlow in Northwest London. And his phone number, they only had his address and phone number, and when I phoned him up, of course, there was already a group going in Willesden, in northwest London, which was about halfway between Edgware and central London. It was about 5 miles away from Edgware going towards London, so it wasn't difficult for me to get there. And there was already a flourishing group under George Wishlow. And so by middle of October, would have been my first appearance at the Wishlow group one Sunday evening, where they used to hold their Sunday evening group meetings. And I turned up there and met George Wishlow, and we were underway. Things were moving. Nobby was never all that keen. He never did appear at the group meetings. He was quite happy to continue on with our co-auditing, but he never took part in any of the public activities at all. It must be realised, from my rather sheltered background of my life, and I wasn't very old, that I was entering a really new world when I entered the Wishlow group, because the first Sunday I went down there was about 40 people there, and many of them were eminent psychologists, the medical profession was represented, and there was a bit of the lunatic fringe, and there was George Wishlow, who was quite a character as George. He was a man of about 45 to 50, and he was a professional magician, professional conjurer, professional strongman. He was a naturopath. He could do a few things with bones too, a bit of an osteopath. There wasn't much George Wishlow could do. He could even audit as well. So I was quickly made very welcome as another book auditor. And I discovered that there was other groups in London starting up. There was a group in East London run by a fellow called Stanley Richards. And I got the address of Stanley Richards and wrote to him. And there was another group in Battersea run by an Ann Walker, and the Battersea group. And there was a Central London group. I forget who was running that, but I wrote to all of them. And I was such a good communicator that George Wishlow immediately, within a couple of weeks, he elected me secretary of the group. I was the group secretary. I was the group communicator of the Wishlow Northwest London Dianetic group. And George also, a great character that he was, George, was one thing he was very bad at, and that was his tech. Tech used to go in one ear of George and out through the other. But that didn't stop him from being a great auditor. He had a natural flair for auditing, even though he couldn't impart the skills of it, the tech of it, to other people. He simply was a very, very poor teacher. He couldn't hold the tech, but he could do it himself. It was a peculiar state of affairs. And as was always so many technical questions on the subject of Dianetics to be answered at the group, and George quickly found out that I was, even in those days, was showing the characteristics of being an encyclopedia on the subject, and that I had no such limitations to my knowledge of the tech and understanding and grasp of the tech. And he quickly was fielding the technical questions over to me, and in the group meetings. Meanwhile, our auditing with Nobby was going on very, very well. I was making marvellous gains. My shyness was vanishing almost visibly. Yet there was no specific engram that we ever contacted that was to do with my nervousness or shyness. But the more prenatals I ran and the more late-light secondaries I ran, the less shy and nervous I became. It was just a lifting accumulated charge. Nobby too was making good with slower gains. I soon realised that he was a much heavier case to audit than I was. He had much more deeper psychological problems than I had. He had some rather deep-seated sexual problems, did poor old Nobby. He wasn't a sexual nut or anything. He wasn't any form of sexual monster. He wasn't homosexual or anything like that. He just had a few very deep-seated sexual quirks, that was all. And He was quite natural. His instincts were quite natural towards the opposite sex, but he was almost totally inhibited from doing anything about it by his quirks. But to jump forward into the future, Nobby did finally. Sigmund Freud always used to say that when a person can't marry, can't get along with the opposite sex, and can't get married, and goes into therapy, that one thing that signals the success of their therapy is when the person ups and gets married, and that can be taken as a success of the therapy. And Freud would be absolutely right when he made that remark. And Nobby, in 1951, about a year after we started auditing, he came in and announced to me one day that I knew he was going around with this girl. He announced that he was engaged and would soon be getting married. And that, of course, really did terminate our auditing, because at that point onwards, we had no more time, once he got married, to engage this activity. So we can say that the auditing I gave Nobby was successful. It was a success. But he didn't make anywhere near, in his own estimation, he was quite happy with the results he got. But in my estimation, I got much more out of it than he did. The response of both our parents and our families was fascinating. Both my parents considered the whole thing was mumbo jumbo, highly dangerous, and if we weren't careful, we'd drive each other mad. And his parents shared the same attitude. All of our parents, both parents and both families, thought that we were quite insane to even attempt such a project as this. And they, of course, were quite, they took the conventional view that thou shalt not tamper with thy mind or thy will go insane. That was the view they held. But after a few months of therapy, even my parents had to admit that I was more alert and more sparkling and far less withdrawn and nervous than I had been previously. Both of them did acknowledge it and admit it, that it did seem to be doing me some good, although Dad was rather doubtful whether it would do me any good in the long run. He was very pessimistic with my dad on the subject. Another big case gain I made in my Dianetic auditing with Nobby was that I had been a black case. When I started my auditing, I was a black case. And about two or three months after I started, around about Christmas 1950, I was in session with him one day, and I remember very, very clearly. I was in a road, and I knew the road very well near my childhood home, and there was a front door in front of me, and I needed to know the number of the house. and I knew the number was on the front door. You know, I couldn't see the number on the door, you know, I knew the number was there. See, case-wise, I had accurate impressions, accurate sonic impressions, and accurate visual impressions, but I was black. I never saw anything. I was a black case. I had no actual visual field, or put it another way, I had a black field, whichever way you like. But I was known as a black case. But anyway, in that session there, suddenly I said to myself, the hell with this, I want to see what that number is on that door. And I started to mentally look at the number on the door, and suddenly a chink appeared in the blackness, and the blackness started to move away. And there was the number, there was the door, there was the road, there was the pavement, there was everything, just as I'd remember it, and just as I knew it was as a child. There was the street, there was the memory, in complete technicolour. And my blackness disappeared. By the end of the session, I could move up and down my time tracking, full technicolour visio. The blackness had just gone instantly. It was just I realised many years afterwards, it was simply my power and my intention to see the number on the door. It was, in other words, it was just the power of the spirit there. I was intended to see, to break the blackness, and I broke it. It was my blackness, and I intended to see through it, and I saw through it and got rid of it. I didn't need it anymore. Looking back in retrospect, I realised that I'd never had any need of pictures in my mind as a child, and so I'd never looked at my past properly. I could always recall what I wanted to recall, and I'd never actually had a need to look at things in great detail in my past, and so of course I've never had the ability to do so. I'd never cultivated the ability. When I got into Dianetics, I needed that ability, and so I created that ability to do it, and I broke the blackness and started to see in full technicolour, which I could have done at any time if I'd really put my mind to it. I firmly believe that all black cases are of that nature. They simply have never learnt the ability. They've never needed the ability. And if they really was to can be guided to break the blackness any time they want to. Anyway, in later years, when I became quite an expert on black cases, because my subjective experience of being a black case when I started off in therapy and breaking my own occlusion gave me, I was an authority on the subject of the black case. There was no other Scientologist I knew in London who'd been a black case and broken his blackness. I was the only one. So I was quite justified in calling myself an authority on the subject of black cases. But one should not take away the good auditing I got from Nobby, because without that auditing I would never have broken through that black field. So one cannot detract from the fine auditing I got from my co-auditor. He really did make it possible, even though in the final instance, of course, it was the pre-clear that did it. So the acclaim must go to the co-auditor, to the auditor in the session who did it. So it's a positive mark for my auditor Nobby, who broke through my blackness for me. Another sign of my considerable case gain was that in group meetings I was able to actually, George would often just simply give me the floor. You know, he would call me over to the front table to answer a technical question and walk away and leave me there handling me all the technical questions for the whole group for half an hour at a time. Now, 6 months before my Dianetic auditing, I would have just run away from a crowd like that. I mean, there I was confronting a whole crowd of people there and answering rather involved technical questions on the subject of Dianetics, and not batting an eyelid, not feeling a shred of nervousness. It was a signal success of my therapy, that was. Although I didn't know it at the time, what was happening was I was simply becoming more causative as a being over my life and my environment. That was all that was happening to me, so of course the nervousness was falling away. Of things I took on, another chore I took on, well not a chore, but another activity I took on at the group meeting was the subject of auditing demos. There's always a difficulty in a group meeting. Newcomers always want to see a demonstration, and it's a very difficult thing to select a subject for the demonstration. Although we had plenty of group members who were in therapy, most of them had heavy cases, and it was not easy to put them into session and be able to run something and get it all cleared up in 20 minutes or half an hour, which was the only time we had for the demonstration. And we didn't like leaving group members stuck in heavy hairy engramic material for a shortage of time. Two or three group members got stuck on this, got caught on this, and eventually they settled on me. They found out that that I, because of my nature as a person, because of the nature of my bank, it was quite okay to put me into session. I could go into session quite easily, could go into a prenatal engram, even one I'd never come across before, and run it, and come out the other end of it, and I could run it to the clock. You know, the auditor had 20 minutes to go, he could run me through it, and when the time to come at the end of the demonstration, you could simply fish me out of it and get me into present time, and I needed hardly negligible stabilisation in present time, and had no ill effects whatsoever. This was a peculiarity that I had. I'd always had that right from the beginning of my therapy, was that it was only many, many years later that I understood the mechanism that causes it. You see, the heavier a case is, the more the bits of his bank get connected up to the other bits of his bank. It's the old A equals A equals A mechanism that Hubbard spoke about in Dianetics, that the more his bank is reacting against him, the more his every part of his mind is connected to every other bit. So you put him into therapy and tackle one engram, that engram jangles, and that jangles is connected to something else. And the next thing, you've got half a dozen engrams jangling. And you see what I'm getting at? So what, this sort of pre-clear is not suitable for a 15-minute, 20-minute demonstration. You need a pre-clear where you can go in like a surgeon, you know, you can make a quick incision, go in, run a quick engram and get out. And you can only do that on a high-level pre-clear. A pre-clear who has not carrying much charge on his bank. So although I never realised it at the time, I was always a rather easy running pre-clear. I had very little charge on this lifetime. There was very little trauma in my childhood, you know. I was an only child, led a rather sheltered life. Nothing of any great horror had ever happened to me, of any great significance. And so I had very little charge there. So that allowed me to go into session very easily at these group demonstration meetings. George pounced on this because he was very concerned about putting people into session for demonstration purposes and having them feeling a bit squiffy the following day, but he found that he could do it with me. He found that he could do almost anything with me in therapy. It didn't mean a thing, you know. I could get the case gains and stabilise in the present time almost instantly. This had some rather peculiar effects on me as an auditor afterwards, which I won't mention at the moment, but because it'll be out of sequence. But various people at that group became quite well known in the early days of Scientology in the UK. Dennis O'Connell, he was a member of the group, and his girlfriend Olive, she never became particularly active in HASI, but Dennis O'Connell was very active in HASI. George Wishlow himself became very active in HASI, and I of course became very active in the London HASI. So quite a number of the members of that group became very, very active. Early in 1951, a fellow strolled into the group by the name of Ray Reeves, and he was an electronic wizard. And we were already I'd written over to America. Volney Matheson had dreamed up the first e-meter circuit, and Ron was raving about e-meters. And I'd written over to America and got the electronic circuit of an e-meter over from one of the groups, and I handed it over to Ray Reeves in 1951, this was, and he took it away and built a beautiful e-meter in a case, in an Hitachi case. It was a power meter. It was a beautiful little job with a light on it and everything, and called it the Emodet. I fell in love with it right away and realised its immediate use, and he used it, and so I immediately ordered one from him, and he built an exact replica for me. And we had the only decent e-meters in London. Eventually others started to come over from the UK, from America. The Matheson meters started to come over and become more used, but they weren't as good as the Ray Reeves meter, as the Emo. He called it the Emodet, emotion detector, the Emodet. He only made about three or four, And I don't know what happened to them. They were still, I'd love to have got the circuit he used. I never did get the circuit he used. I never bothered to ask him for it. It wasn't quite the same as the Matheson circuit, but it was a very, very fine circuit he built there. And he was a bit of an expert on E-meters, Ray Reeves. Well, he was a qualified electronics engineer. He was a first-class man in his field. And he taught me an awful lot about meters and so forth. And eventually I became quite an authority on the subject of a good E-meter. And he never did build a good E-meter. All the best E-meters ever built were built by people in the field. The Ron was not a good judge of an E-meter. He was not a good judge, so he was unable to evaluate the meters that it were being sold by Hesse. There were far, far better meters, more cheaper to make, were available in the field. It always was that way in Scientology, and it's still that way today. So towards the middle to end of 1951, I was a busy boy, a very busy boy. We had the group there, and was still carrying on my auditing, although, of course, Nobby was, I finished with Nobby, he'd gone off and got married, and Ray and I were co-auditing, Ray Reeves and myself, we were co-auditing now, and I was progressing with my case gains, and I was getting stuck into Ray Reeves's case. He lived in Southall in Middlesex, and we used to have a couple of sessions a week. I was still keeping my dance band work going, and just had my daytime job, and I was a very, very busy boy. But then in the late summer of 1951, a guy called Jack Horner turned up, an American auditor, turned up in London to give a congress. And he brought with him his clear. And dear Jack, he was a great guy, Jack. He wasn't physically a big man, but it was a lot of him psychologically. I like Jack Horner, although a lot of people didn't care for him very much. But he had a number of weaknesses, Jack Horner. One was that he was a great one for the women. And we found out later that this idea of him turning up, he'd been turning up all over the world with clears. And all these clears had two things in common. Every clear he ever turned up with was a beautiful girl. That was number one. And number two was that she was sleeping with Jack Horner. Well, this would have been quite all right, except Jack Horner had a wife back in California. And you could see that he was somewhat mixing business with pleasure, Jack Horner was. But nevertheless, he turned up with his beautiful clear and at the Congress. But it was a memorable Congress for me, that one he held in 1951. That was the first Congress ever held in London. All the group people turned up there, people who I'd been in contact with, I met Stanley Richards. I'd phoned up and spoken to on the telephone. We'd written to each other, but we never actually met. We met at that Congress in 1951, and at the first morning of the Congress, I was sitting there in a chair, and a startlingly beautiful auburn-haired woman walked across the floor, and I just went, "My God, what a jam! What a beautiful woman!" And I made some discreet inquiries and found out that her name was Ann Walker. That was the head of the Battersea Group. The funny thing is that we'd spoken over the telephone, Ann and I, and we'd written to each other on more than one occasion, but we'd never met, you see. And, so she was as surprised to meet me as I was to meet her. And we got on absolutely famously together. We went out and had lunch that day, and well, things went on from there, and we subsequently got married, and never looked back. It was love at first sight for me when I saw that startlingly beautiful auburn-haired woman walk across the floor. The great thing about it was our relationship was that she had a family of children, a marvellous family of two young children. Well, weren't all that young. There was a 13-year-old and an 13-year-old boy, a strapping young lad of 13. And a delightful 11-year-old daughter. And I love children, but I was never keen on young children and babies. And I think that's a lovely age to inherit a family, is to go in and get a family of 13 and 11. And we were great friends and always have been, although all down the years with Anne's children. I never came the heavy father on them. I made it quite clear from the beginning that I was not their dad. And I was just Dennis, and I've always been just Dennis to them, and I've never imposed upon them in any way whatsoever. I just took the relationship as it came, and it's worked out very, very well. So it was a marvellous thing right from the word go, that was. The next thing of real import to happen was in August 1952, when I got a phone call one evening from George saying that Ron Hubbard's in town in London, arrived unexpectedly, and that there was every chance that he would be at the Wishlow group meeting that following Sunday. Wow, our spirits went through the roof. Here was the master himself had turned up, and he was going to visit the various groups. The first one on his itinerary was our group, the Wishlow group. We were the first one he was going to visit on the Sunday. And then he was going to visit the Central London group and so forth, if he had time. But he was certainly, George was very optimistic, as he'd spoken to Ron. He was very optimistic, and Ron had given his word that he would be there, and George had got everyone in sight to come. And so we all, with bated breath, we all went down there that Sunday evening to George's front room. He had a big front room there, but a big Victorian house, and it was a large front room, but we were quite used to having 30 people in that room, even 35 or 40, but when I got there, there was already 60 people there, about 60 people, and they were beginning to hang from the chandeliers. This is going to be quite an evening, this is. And there was the room there. We'd run out of chairs. It was standing room only. They were sitting on the floors, and they were sitting on the sideboards, and it was no Ron had turned up yet. And we were just beginning to wonder whether he was ever going to come. And George had got proceedings underway, and about 8:30 in the evening, there was a knock at the door, and the great man entered. And that was my first sight of Ron Hubbard, a rather large man, imposing psychologically. You could never miss Ron Hubbard's presence. When he walked into a room, you turned. Whether you were facing him or not, you knew someone had come in. He was an impressive man. An impressive physically and impressive psychologically. He was a big man, about 240 pounds of Ron, and 6 foot, and big physically to match, and big psychologically. And in those days, he had a mass of flaming red hair. In 1952, he was in his prime. He was 41 years old, Ron was, and he was in his physical prime. Although Mary Sue was arrived in London with him, he never brought her to the group meeting. He turned up by himself, and he quickly took over the whole of the proceedings and started, gave us a talk, and we just sat there rapt. And he started talking about exteriorization. We'd heard about exteriorization from the groups in America, but none of us knew very much about it. But we just heard that there was such a thing as exteriorization, and he started to talk about exteriorization. And he kept us enthralled there for about an hour, and then suddenly he stopped and said, I need a subject, he said, for a demonstration on the subject of exteriorization. He said, it's no good me talking about it anymore, I want to demonstrate it to you, you'll see it for yourself. And so he said, anyone like to come forward for a demonstration? And I thought to myself, well, I'm the pet guinea pig of the group, and but I thought, well, I'll let somebody else go on this one, they'll all want to go forward. And there was a dreadful silence. I looked round. There wasn't a hand up in sight. Even George Wishlow wasn't game on this one. So my hand shot up. He looked at me, Ron did, and grinned. And said, what's your name? And introduced myself. And he said, come and sit down over here. And sat down at the table. And he put me into session. And my life was never the same afterwards. He just got me to communicate with my foot and give my foot a command, and then he asked me to contact the comm line between on the command going between me and my foot, and what colour was it. I told him it was a bit murky, and he said, turn it white, and now get your foot to give you a command, and what colour is it, and it's a bit murky, well, turn it white. And the next moment I was flying around the room. There was this great big table George had in the room, big circular oriental table. It was a masterpiece. It was very old, very, very valuable, and it had a very complex mosaic, oriental mosaic pattern in brilliant technicolor on the top of it. And you imagine this situation. There's Ron sitting at one side of the of the, not at this table, the table was in the, almost in the middle of the room. In the corner of the room there was a smaller table, and Ron was sitting on one side of it, and it was me sitting on the other side of it with my head slumped forward, and Ron was auditing, and I was sitting up on the ceiling, and it was in full Technicolor, much more brilliantly than I'd ever seen before in my life, was the Technicolor of the mosaic on this table. And he asked me what I was looking at, and I told him, and he moved me around the room, and I was up on the ceiling looking down on all these people, and it was the wildest scene. There's me looking down on these people sitting there, and they're all looking at my body sitting at the chair at the table, and there's Ron there sitting on there, and they're all looking at the body, and I'm up on the ceiling looking down at them. And he moved me around, and I moved me out into the road, and he moved me, stabilised me in present time, and got me round back behind my head. And then he said, in his drawl, he said, "Well, where would you like me to? Where would you like to be when we end the session?" I said, "Well, I'm quite happy here, Ron." He said, "Well, that's fine." He said, "And that's where you shall be when we end the session." So he ended the session off, and it was absolutely incredible. He answered a few more questions, and I went back to my place, and it was getting on to half past 10, and I'd already in danger of missing my last transport, and the group pretty well quickly broke up, and we all went away, and I walked home, and I was about 19 foot tall. I was still exteriorised. I got the last bus up the Edgware Road, got off at Edgware, and I had about a mile and a half to walk. I'd missed my last bus to where we lived. I had to walk about a mile and a half, and it was the most incredible. I was still exteriorized. When I closed my eyes, I could see just as clearly, or if not more clearly, with my eyes closed than I could with my eyes open in present time. It's an incredible perception I had, absolutely incredible. Clear detail, never known anything like it through vision, through my eyes. I was walking along the road in the dark, and there's the street lights there, and I was behind my head. And as the street lights would move along, I was walking, and as the street lights passed, would come out of the shadow of my head. They'd shine on me where I was exteriorized behind my head, and I'd be startled by the bright light of the street light appearing around the side of my head. And I wondered what the hell it was. So I closed my eyes, and I realised I could walk quite just as comfortably along the road with my eyes closed. And so I walked nearly half a mile along that road with my eyes closed, with the body walking in front of me. It was the most incredible experience I've ever had in my life. I got indoors, got into bed, and exteriorised around the room, giving myself the commands that Ron had been giving me. And went out into the garden, got up onto the roof, and it eventually sat out on the top of the lamppost there, on top of the electric light bulb. And there was one solitary moth. I always remember it. It was very late in the year for a moth. There was one solitary moth fluttering around the electric light bulb. And it was me watching this moth go around this electric light bulb. And I was sitting out there, and I stayed out there. And I must have drifted off to sleep, because when I woke up in the morning, I'd come back into my body again. So I went to sleep sitting on top of the lamppost. But I felt absolutely incredible. I was absolutely a new person. What I didn't know at the time, Ron Grosby, he seemed to sense this, that there was such a thing as a theta clear, that when you took a person and exteriorized them, that you could clear them. It was a clearing mechanism. And I don't think it was, maybe Ron really understood it, but a lot of us never really grasped it. So what was going on was that we didn't really know this about clearing in those days, was that clearing isn't really a matter of how many engrams you run or how much charge you take off the bank. Clearing is really an attitude of mind. It's bringing the person up to a point where he realizes that he can handle his mind and handle his life. And that's all clearing is there. It's not a question of engramic charge. It's a question of being able to handle things and position things in space and in time and so forth. As that ability, that confidence comes up that one can do this, one becomes more and more clear, and one gets more and more case gains. And that's the inner secret of the inner secret. That's why exteriorization is a clearing is a clearing phenomenon. You can exteriorize a person, and they immediately feel free, and because they can now move away from the center of their being. And they now can move, you see, where before they were trapped. You've now given them a freedom. So you've now given them back an ability which they didn't have before. And so now you've changed their state of case. So exteriorization is a clearing procedure. And I didn't realize it. What I hadn't known up to then was that the auditing I'd had, I was already a low-level clear from the auditing I'd had. That was demonstrated by the fact that I could do these group demonstrations. You know, it was almost impossible to throw me case-wise in a group demonstration. That they could throw me in a session, run an engram, take me out of session, bring me in at present time, and it was, you know, I was quite okay. There was no other member of the group they could do this on. And I thought it was odd at the time. I thought it was just a natural ability I had. But then, as the years passed, and looking back at it in retrospect, the reason I could do it was that I was clear. And exteriorizing me had cleared me even further. And I was in pretty darn good case shape at that point in time. Incredible case shape. The exteriorization perception never maintained. It never held. It faded. Well, it couldn't have held. I mean, it was so brilliant that I would have had to have put bandages over my eyes. You know, I couldn't have lived with it. I think I shut it off to stay human. It was so incredibly bright, the perception was. And it validated everything Ron said about exteriorization, about the theta. There's no doubt of what he was talking about. I mean, Ron wasn't making this up. There was such a thing as a thing. And people were just what he says they were. You know, I mean, it wasn't just a figment of his imagination. Like, here was me experiencing it exactly as he said it. And it couldn't be any other explanation of what I was experiencing. It was exactly as he said it was. So that was a turning moment in my life. That was that group meeting in late August 1952, with that demonstration session there. That's when I became clear. A few years afterwards, when some order to put me on an e-meter and asked me, when was the last time you went? When was the first time you know you went clear? It always ticks on that demonstration session that Ron gave me when he exteriorized me, because that was the first time I was absolutely certain. Although I'm now looking back further, I realized that even before that I was clear, but that was the certainty came to me that I was clear at that point when he exteriorized me. There was another incredible thing about it was when I looked at it in retrospect too, that of all the people in that room, I don't know whether there couldn't have been many he could have done that with. He could have exteriorized quite a number of them with the techniques he had at his disposal, but I don't think there was any he could have done it with whose cases were in as good a condition as my case. Well, you see, the thing was, the better case condition the person was in, the better they responded and the more benefit they got from the exteriorization procedure. You see, the thing was cumulative. The worse off the case was, the less benefit they got from the exteriorization procedure. I was in good case shape. I was probably in better case shape than anybody else in the room. And it just so happened that when he asked that I volunteered. But I gave everyone else in the room the chance to volunteer first for to be the subject of the demonstration, and nobody took it. I happened to be the best case shape of the room. I put my hand up last and got the case benefit. Now, isn't that interesting? Did Ron know this? You know, one can speculate this thing backwards and forwards forever. He got the best result possible because he audited the case that was in the person who was in the best case shape in the room. But the person in the best case shape in the room gave everyone else the chance to take part in the demonstration, and none of them took the opportunity. Now, isn't that interesting? It tells you something very interesting about the engram bank, if you think about it. Well, from this point onwards, things move rather rapidly. I was at work a few days afterwards, and I couldn't get down to the London group meeting where Ron turned up. He did turn up at the London group, but I couldn't manage it because I had a dance band job. It was on a Wednesday evening. I had a dance band job that evening, and I couldn't break the appointment. So I had to turn up, do my dance band job, so I didn't go down to the London group. But apparently he did an auditing demonstration there on exteriorisation, and it was a complete washout. He got absolutely nowhere with the person. And he obviously, I don't know who it was, but he picked someone whose case was in far worse shape than mine, and he just didn't have any success. But anyway, I didn't attend that one. But a week or so afterwards, I was at work one day, and Dennis O'Connell, I mentioned his name, he was already one of the group members, and he phoned up. He said, Ron's starting the HPA course next Monday. Next Monday? This was a Thursday. He says, next Monday it starts. I said, where's it being held at? He said, in my flat. I said, you're joking. He said, no, I'm not. He said, I've offered my flat to Ron. Ron's got no other place to run it. And I said, well, where the hell are you going to live? I said, you've only got that one room. You see, Dennis hadn't lived there in that one room flat. It was a big room there, but it was just the one big room and the kitchen attached. And that was their living space. And the toilet and bathroom was outside, which they shared with other members of the people who lived in the house. And they only had that one room. I said, hey, you're going to, how long's the course go on for? He said, 8 weeks. I said, you won't manage it, mate. I said, you'll have to go and live in a hotel. Oh, no, he said, we'll struggle on. So he said, well, we start next Monday. And he said, can we put your name down? I said, well, how much is it? He said, well, hold your breath. He said, just hold your hat on. He says, £125. And he said, worst is to come. He says, bat your ears back. He said, it's cash on the barrel. He says, you pay the money before you start. I said, what the hell's going on? He said, well, Ron needs the money. He wants to open up a Hazzy in London. He hasn't got any funds. All his funds are apparently tied up in America. And he's got no ready cash. And he's going to run this course, and he wants the money to put the money down to start the organisation in London. So he can't give terms at this stage, he said. But he said, anyone who does this course, he said, will be assured of a future. And I said, well, I'll have to think about it. And, £125 doesn't sound very much these days. But the average wage in those days was £8 a week. I was earning about £8 a week. And well, you ride, it's about 16 weeks' wages. Well, in 1993, the average wage is about $500 a week. And you multiply $500 by 16, you end up with $8,000. So I was virtually being asked on a Thursday afternoon to collect $8,000 in my hot little hand and arrive with that amount of money the following Monday morning at an address 10 miles down the road. You know, it was quite a large sum of money to part with. And I said to Dennis over the phone, I said, it's a lot of money. He said, yep. He said, but there's a lot signing up. He says, Richards is in. Stan Richards is signing up. He reckons he'll have to sell his shirt, Stan does, but he's going to be there next Monday morning. And he said, well, Olive and I will be there naturally. And he said, but we're getting a reduction, he said, because we're letting him have our flat. He said, we couldn't afford it otherwise. He said, but we're letting him have our flat, and he's giving us a good reduction. That's the only way we can get on the course. So that's why he let Ron have his flat. It's the only way Dennis and Olive could get on the course. And George will be on it, he said. George Wishaw will be on it. And all the old hands were going to be on it. Anne wouldn't be on it, she couldn't afford it. So I thought to myself, well, I'll have to let you know, Dennis, it's a lot of money. And although I had the money, I thought to myself, what am I going to do with it? So after he rang off, I thought, well, what the hell, I might as well. I'm not getting anywhere with this day job. I might as well become a professional Dianeticist, a professional Scientologist, and throw my hat into that area. I'm getting nowhere here, fiddling about with my dance band work in the evening. I might as well take the plunge. So I phoned him up that evening. You can count me in. He said, oh, marvellous, he said. And I'll be there on Monday morning. He said, don't forget to bring the money with you. He said, Ron's not joking. He said, if you don't bring the money, he said, you won't start. So over the weekend, I went down to the post office and drew out 125 smackers. Put them in my pocket, gave my notice in instantly, and that cost me a week's wages. And Monday morning, told my parents that I was going to take this course, and they thought I was mad. Anyway, Monday morning found me there on the HPA course, and Dennis was absolutely right. There was about 20 starters at 9 o'clock in the morning, and about 24, I think I counted, about 24. And Ron gave a little introductory talk. No, this was about 10 o'clock we started, wasn't it? No, about 10 o'clock was the starting time. Ron gave an introductory course, answered a few questions, and we had an early lunch, and Mary Sue came round with her hat in her hand, and she wanted the money, and I parted with my 125 smackers. And after lunch, there was only 16 of us left. There was eight would-be hopefuls who'd come down on the off chance that they could start. They'd gone in the afternoon. It was cash on the barrel, and no cash, no start. So on the Monday afternoon, the 16 of us that were left were started on the first HPA course. There was a number of professional hypnotists and the odd psychotherapist, a guy called Oscar Collerstrom and his wife. Both were carried doctorates. I don't know whether they were doctors of science or whether they were doctors of they weren't medical doctors, I think. I think Gene Collerstrom was a doctor of science, but the other guy, her husband, who looked just like a taller edition of Sigmund Freud, complete with beard, he was in, and he was a decent enough guy. He was a professional psychoanalyst, and been practicing in London for years. I found out later, he was one of London's better known psychoanalysts, and he was Freudian up to his eyeballs, was Oscar. He was in, and there was a lot of people from the London, Central London group were in. Stan Richards turned up, still got his shirt on, but he turned up. Georgie Wishlow was there. I don't know what George had to sell to get rid of him. Maybe he sold his table. Never did see that table again. I think he must have sold that table. But anyway, George was there. And I mean, this course we were doing was intensive. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, and it would drag on. We'd have the classes and lectures from Ron, and then we'd do some auditing in the afternoon, and Ron would be back in the evening, we'd be lecturing again. And two evenings a week, he used to let the public come in, and anyone could come in for public lectures by Ron Hubbard. And before Dennis and I left, I remember once or twice I said to him, "How the hell are you getting on in the middle of the course?" I said, "How are you managing?" He said, "It's awful." He said, "We don't even get into bed. We have to look under the bed before we get into it." He said, "There might be a couple of students under there doing a bit of auditing." He said, "It's awful." I don't know really how they managed, but they survived it somehow, the two of them. Really, there was that place empty before midnight. They couldn't have got into bed till after midnight, and they had to be out of bed again and get the place all ready for the course by 9 o'clock the following morning. God knows how they lived during that period, but they managed it. Anyway, Ron was as good as his word. While the course was going on, he was investing the money that he'd got, and the next thing we knew was that he got some premises. He rented some premises at 103 Holland Park Avenue, 163 Holland Park Avenue. That was about 400 yards, quarter of a mile from Holland Park Avenue Station. On the Bayswater in Holland Park Avenue Road, Bayswater, continuation of Bayswater Road, there, 163 Holland Park Avenue, on the corner of one of the side turnings. And that was London's first HAS, Hubbard Association of Scientologists. And halfway through the course one evening, Anne phoned me up. Of course, I hadn't seen much of Anne. I was so damn busy on the course. She phoned me up and said she'd thrown her job in. Ron had been in, she'd been in touch with Ron, and he needed someone to look after the office down there, and he picked on her right away, because she had she was a trained secretary and had excellent typing skills. She could do shorthand and what have you, and he's just the person I need. You can look after the office. So she chucked her job in and got a much higher, more highly paid job with Ron at 163 Holland Park Avenue. So while the course was finishing off, Anne was already working down at 163 Holland Park Avenue. She was the office staff. She was all of it. And keeping everything going down there, keeping the place warm for when the rush would start after the course was finished. Ron, one had to admit that Ron Hubbard was a man of action. that once he got this mock-up going, he didn't hesitate. He wasn't a hesitator. He was a man of action. Things were moving. They were moving fast in October, November 1952. Of course, as soon as I got a bit of time, I saw a bit of daylight towards the end of the course, and things began to ease off a bit. I was seeing more of Anne. She was avid for all the data. I was spending hours teaching all the data I was learning on the course, so she didn't really miss anything. She got it all from me. She got the whole gang lot of it from me. She was a wonderful learner, data. She only had to get it once and she had it. So she didn't really miss anything by not being on the course. And she was still auditing and in the evenings, but very little of it because she was so damn busy down at Hazy. The course ended and I used to go down to down the Hazy to in the evening to pick up Anne to take her home, or sometimes we'd go out for a meal and then go home. There was a children and so forth, and then one evening I was sitting there about 6:30 waiting for Anne to finish off a bit of typing, and we usually hoped to get away about 7:00, and suddenly the door burst open and in came Ron, breezed in, looked me up and down. He said, you're London's first director of processing, Dennis. I said, am I? He said, yes. He said, you've just been elected. I said, well, thanks very much, Ron. What do I have to do? He said, the first thing you can do, he said, is to give these damned new HPA students some auditing. I said, what HPA students? I said, you don't mean us? He said, no. He said, you're ex-HPA students. You've finished, he said. Next Monday morning, he said, we've got an HPA course starting next door. Dennis O'Connell's going to be running it. He said, we're going to use the tapes that I've been cutting with you people. He said, and I've got some more tapes coming over by email from the States. O'Connell's going to be the instructor. He says, and those poor students are going to need some good auditing. He said, we're going to give them some good quality auditing. Every student who does that course is going to get at least 5 hours of top quality auditing, he said, and I can't think of a better person to give it to them than you. So he said, you're the new director of processing. Now your first job is to give each one of those students who starts next Monday 5 hours of auditing. I said, good on you, Ron. And I was London's first DFP, first director of processing. And as I walked out the road, walked out with Anne that evening down to the bus stop to get home, I said to Anne, I said, here, I've got a marvellous, I said, director of processing. I said, I'm a company director. I said, I'm only 25 years of age. I said, company director. I said, soon it'll be cigars and a Rolls Royce car, because I'd always imagined a company director, you know, you get a Rolls Royce car and you've got a seat on the board and you smoke cigars. I said, I'm only 25 and I'm a company director. And she laughed at me. She said, don't you believe it? She said, it doesn't mean the same in America as it does over here. She said, a director in America is just somebody who directs a department. She said, well, it's like we say somebody would direct the traffic. She said, you're just a manager then. And she said, you're not a company director. No, I'm a company director. But it turned out that Anne was absolutely right. I wasn't going to be a company director. I wasn't going to be a director of Hazy, the company. I was only going to be a manager. Ron used the American term, director. In America, it means just what Anne said it meant. So clearly the time had come for me to leave home. And so I said goodbye to Mum and Dad and got myself a flat in Notting Hill Gate. I had to have somewhere to audit these students. So I got a flat in Notting Hill Gate. Stan Richards was looking for a place in town too. He lived out in Ilford. He needed to get more central for his pre-clears. Most of them were in London. So we teamed up together and got this flat in Notting Hill Gate. And he used to use it during the daytime to audit his pre-clears that he was building up his practice. And I used to use it in the evening for auditing the students. They were on course during the day. I couldn't get to them during the day, but every evening I'd have a couple of them come in. And I used to give two sessions an evening between 6:30 and 8:30 and 9:15 and 10:45. And fit two sessions in an evening. And so it went on. Meanwhile, George Wishlow was on staff. He'd come in as what was called the director of the V staff, the voluntary staff, V for voluntary staff. Ron had this beautiful mock-up of of a voluntary staff. There was one staff member paid, that was George, and his job was to go out and enlist other people to come in and volunteer to do the work, do some work for nothing, and they get paid by having some free auditing or free training. And George was just the man for this. And so George was going to handle the V-staff. George was a superb promoter. That was his real strength. George was a superb promoter, and he proved it. I mean, we always knew he was good, but the man was brilliant. There have been some very brilliant promoters in Scientology over the years, but I never met anyone who was in George's class. Once he got the job, George was down to Hyde Park Corner with his soapbox, took it with him, down on the bus down to Hyde Park Corner, set it up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and started talking to the passers-by about Scientology, Dianetics, until he got a little crowd round him. Then at 7 o'clock in the evening, 6:45, you say, right, come with me, we're going to take you down and give you a little talk, show you the premises, and come and learn some more about this subject. And he'd just take them out of Hyde Park, where he collected, pick up his soapbox, and a whole lot of them would get on the bus, and he'd bring the whole lot of them back into 163 Holland Park Avenue. And by 8 o'clock that evening, he'd have a class there of newcomers into Scientology, sitting there, listening to George Wishlow talking about Dianetics in Scientology, and they'd be buying books and getting pamphlets, and that was George. He was an absolute godsend to the organisation, that man was. I knew of no one else who could anywhere near do what he was doing. None of us were capable of doing it, but to George it was absolutely natural. And he did it absolutely perfectly. He could do it time after time after time, night after night after night. The only nights he couldn't do it was when it was raining and there was nobody in Hyde Park Corner. But any fine night, if the weather was fine, George could go down there, come back with somewhere between 10 and 20 newcomers. He could do it any time he wanted to. He was an incredible promoter, was George Wishlow. And when he died in 1958, died fishing off the rocks in Point Corbière off southwest coast of Jersey by the side of the lighthouse. The big wave came in and swept him away, and his body was never even found. It's one of the most, I know the point well there, I know it well, that Point Corbière, and it's one of the most dangerous spots on the whole Jersey coast for fishing. Very, very dangerous spot. But even though George was a powerful swimmer, he was a physical culture expert, he was a powerful swimmer, he would have stood no chance if he got carried off on those rocks. And as I said, they never found the body. But it was a great loss to Scientology in 1958, was the death of George Wishlow. Because he was the promoter, he was the greatest promoter I'd ever met in Scientology, and I've never heard of anyone else who'd met a better promoter of Scientology. Even Ron Hubbard couldn't promote like George Wishlow could. Things settled down to a somewhat of an even keel. The premises at 163 Holland Park Avenue weren't very big. There was just the front office, and there was the lecture room, and there was one other room which was a sort of an intermediate size. You could use it for a bit of auditing, or you could use it for a small class, but it was one of those in-between size rooms. And then there was the toilet and the washroom, and that was it. There wasn't anything else there. And it was very, very small premises for what was required. And so it was no surprise that Ron was soon looking for more premises. He needed a place for a clinic. It was all very well me doing the auditing in my own flat there, but he realised it was only a stopgap measure, and that sooner or later that he would need a clinic. There was also, of course, this matter of me being the director of processing of the organisation, and it was at that time it was an unpaid position. I was expected to audit these students, give them each one of them 5 hours of auditing, and I wasn't getting any money from the org there. I wasn't a staff member of the org. There was just this tacit understanding that if any inquiries came into the organisation for auditing, until such time as the clinic was properly set up, that I would actually do the auditing, and I could charge the very clear the auditing fee. And This was reasonable because it was my only means of earning a living. Obviously, I couldn't go on auditing the students for nothing forever. And I had to have, during the day, I had to have some means of earning some money. And so that was, it was tacitly agreed that this was what would happen. And so we sort of went on along those lines, but it was not a satisfactory arrangement. I would have far better preferred to have gone onto a salary basis, like Dennis O'Connell was on and Dan was on, and audited the, and then the pre-clears who came into HASI paid their money to HASI, and I would have audited them as a staff auditor. I would have much preferred that, even though I would probably have been financially out of pocket. I was probably doing better financially on the existing arrangement. But anyway, Ron was quite happy with the arrangement, as long as I audited, gave each student 5 hours of auditing and got their case rolling. And if, it was also, he made it clear that if the pre-clear, if the student was in very bad case shape, that that they ought to be encouraged to have some more auditing. There was that, that understanding too. But the whole thing was to get some new premises and get a clinic underway at the time. And there the matter was left in 19, we're now in 1953 and jogging through 1953, and Ron disappeared over in, out of London, took Mary Sue with him, and the whole lot, they all disappeared. I don't know, there was some crisis in the American organisations, we lost Ron, and we went immediately went on an extended comm line to Ron, which was never the best. While we had a close comm line to the old man, we could work with him. But on an extended comm line, we began to get misunderstandings on the line and so forth, and things got started to get strained because he was getting wild reports from all sorts of the lunatic fringe about what was going on in HASI, and all of it was quite untrue. It was just business as usual in the HASI. Anne was doing a fine job. She was virtually the administrator, and the technical was being looked after by O'Connell during the daytime, and Stan Richards and doing the evening courses. He was on evenings and weekends, and I was looking after the auditing side of things. And it was good roads and good weather. Everybody was getting a good service. The students were getting trained. The pre-clears were getting audited. The bills were getting paid. And Anne was working herself into the ground as the administrator, looking after everything else. And that was the way the org was running. Oh, and George was running the PE courses and doing his V staff and so forth, and giving us a supply of new people. The mock-up was running. It was a stable going concern. It was, you know. But we knew that in the org, we knew that there was a fair bit of N-theta going to run from various sections, and some of the other auditors in London weren't happy with this arrangement. They knew that that HASI was getting inquiries for auditing from the general public, and they knew that these auditing inquiries were being farmed out to me, and they of course knew of the relationship between Anne and I. And even though I kept it no secret from anyone, and the org never kept it a secret that I was the director of processing of HASI, and that I was a staff member, that they didn't think it right that I should be doing the auditing out there, and so on. Somehow the secret got out, the word got out that that I was charging these that the money was going to me and not going to the organisation. And even though I was telling people that I'm not, my position with the organisation is unpaid. I'm not drawing a salary, but I do hold a position with the organisation. And as soon as we get a clinic, I'll be taking up my full-time post as director of processing as a salaried staff member, because that was as far as I knew what was going to happen. But it still wasn't good. There was a lot of ill feeling about it. There was one hell of a lot of auditors who were getting trained and were quite unwilling to get off their backsides and go out and get themselves some pre-clears. That was the simple truth of the matter. And so they were casting greedy, envious eyes upon me, who was doing a lot of auditing, and because they all were passing me pre-clears, and they didn't understand the position there, that there was they all were putting their pre-clears out to the best auditor they knew, That was me. That was Ron's instructions. They were putting him out to me because they could rely upon me as an auditor. And but you couldn't tell this to the other auditors, you see. So there was naturally a fair bit of entheta going backwards and forwards there. And Ron was evidently believing some of it, and there was a lot of other lies going on at the time too. As I say, while we had Ron local and handy, we could handle it, and so we could remain in communication. But once we got on an extended comm line, when he was in the United States and it was all on airmail letters, then the lies started to get to Ron, and he, being the man he was, he started to believe the lies. At this time, of course, the little group of Georgie Wishlow, Dennis O'Connell, Stan Richards, Anne and I, we'd been together working with Hazzy now for some months, and we're developing a considerable amount of affinity for each other and a great understanding of each other's modes of working and so forth. We were developing into a very, very efficient team, very, very efficient. And I think that, looking back in hindsight, I think that also contributed to the difficulties that occurred immediately afterwards, that Ron got the wind that we were becoming a closely knit team, and he because of the personality, the type of person that he was, that he couldn't tolerate that. He felt that was a danger to him, that his staff might one day gang up on him, and try and take the org away from him, or deprive him in some way of his own organisation. Remember, he always was slightly paranoid, Ron. He had marked paranoid tendencies from all the years I knew him. And so we would expect such paranoid behaviour from such a man. And in those circumstances, it wouldn't be unusual for a person with paranoid tendencies to experience some trepidation at his own staff members getting on so well together and working so well together as a team. Anyway, the crunch came around about sometime in April, May 1953. Their airmail letter came over from the old man. Anne was sacked, and my services were no longer required, and this threw the whole place into a pandemonium. I wasn't in the org when Anne read that. She picked up the mail, she read it, she spoke to Dennis O'Connell. He was there on the during the day course, and he immediately phoned me, and Stan Richards was in on it, and that very night there was a whole, George Wishlow came along too, and we had a sort of council of war. The rest of them were ready to throw in their resignations for Anne and I. Said that either, you know, if you sack Anne and I, you sack the rest of us too. You've lost the lot if you sack those two. But Anne and I said, no, don't do that. It's a misunderstanding. It will come back right. And we didn't understand Ron at the time. We didn't know about his paranoia. And we thought it's simply a misunderstanding. It'll all blow over. So we pacified Dennis O'Connell and George Wishlow, and Dan and I pacified the other staff members down, and we left it at that. But I do know that they, all three of them, wrote stiff letters to the old man saying that this was a gross injustice, that breaking the team up, and that neither Anne or I had done anything to deserve being fired. But nothing came back on the line from the old man. No, nothing came back at all. But what did happen? This, I think it happened on the Thursday or the Friday we got the letter. And what did happen was that on the Monday morning, meanwhile Dennis O'Connell got he was a senior tech staff there person. He got a personal email letter from Ron saying that the new administrator will be coming in on Monday morning, and his name was Reg Gould. And he will be taking over. I forget the post. Ron granted him some grandiose title, and he will be taking over Anne's old job, plus lots of more responsibilities. We'll be looking for a new building, and we'll be virtually in charge of the place. We'll be senior to O'Connell, and senior to Stan Richards, and senior to George Wishlow, and which put their backs up immediately, because they were all tech staff and they hated the idea of an administrator being put senior to them, particularly when they found out that nobody had ever heard of Reg Gould. and that he, as far as we knew, he'd had no training. He was a completely unskilled person in the subject of Dianetics and Scientology. Anyway, he turned up on the Monday morning, and by lunchtime, Dennis O'Connell phoned. Oh, meantime, I'd left the flat. I let the flat go. I don't know whether Stanley kept that flat going in Notting Hill Gate for long. I think he let it go too after a while. He held it for a while, but he couldn't hold the rental on it, and he let it go. And I don't know quite where Stan lived after that, but I went and lived in Battersea, and Anne and I got married soon afterwards. And but anyway, that's all really beside the point. On the Monday lunchtime, Dennis O'Connell phoned me and said that the worst, he knows nothing of Scientology. He's supposed to have read the book, but he's an absolute horror. And I made a point of going in. I wasn't auditing that day. I made a point of going in that afternoon, strolling in and talking into the organ, talking to Dennis, and strolling into the office to meet Reg Gould. And of course he'd heard of.